Everybody, Tom Woods here. It's episode 2699 of the Tom Woods Show. And we're joined today by our old friend Keith Knight, managing editor over at the Libertarian Institute, author of Domestic Imperialism. And then is the subtitle, Nine Reasons I Left Progressivism?
It is, yes. And congratulations on getting my title right. That's the first time. You've done an excellent job.
Oh, thank you.
I'm totally satisfied.
Thanks. It's a great book. You can read it in no time at all. But also, Keith is like me in that when he writes a book, he doesn't write it to pad it or fill it with fluff to make sure it hits 300 pages or whatever. Every single page, it's like laser beams right into your eyeballs or something. Like everything is packed with information. He does not waste your time. Which I like. And I dare say this episode will not be a waste of your time. It doesn't matter, and I think it'll become obvious early on, it doesn't matter what your religious allegiances are, if any. That's secondary to what we're driving at in this particular episode. But what we're going to do is something we've done before, because we've done it with Keith in the past a couple of times, and that's because only Keith has had the guts to ask me if he could do this. No one else has asked me. So it just goes to show, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So Keith said, what if I interview you about X or Y? And X or Y is usually one of my books, typically a book celebrating an anniversary. And so Keith, what have you decided to do this time around?
When I came across this article at the New York Post saying that a number of Catholic churches are seeing a 30% increase in converts, I was really surprised. And I thought, well, what is a discussion I could have on Catholicism? And I said, well, there's a book celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, The Church and the Market, written by you. So I thought you and I would go over this excellent contribution to theology and economics, harmonizing the two.
Absolutely. Doggone it. I think I got them all downstairs now, my books. But there's a 10th anniversary edition from 10 years ago that has a much sleeker, much nicer cover than that hideous green thing. But you're an originalist, you know, as in everything. You got the original version, the collector's edition. I appreciate that. But the other one is super, super great. It's got an extra chapter in it that I wrote. And I'm telling you, it's weird having a book of your own have a 20th anniversary. That's not right. You know, that's not right. It shouldn't be happening, but here we are.
Well, I still love this image on the front. It says, The Charity of St. Thomas Aquinas. So I think it's a great
In topic. Principle, there's nothing wrong with it. Just the execution could have been better.
Let's begin with the introduction. You talk about the justification for needing a discussion on economics in general. So if I'm someone who says, I just want a society with stable families, I want job security, I want the mass home ownership that I saw in the 1950s with the boomer generation, why are you graph worshippers bugging me with economics jargon when I'm here talking about vitally important things for an orderly civilization?
Well, it's funny you asked me that, because that very topic is also what I'm going to be talking about this year at the Mises Institute Supporters Summit. I think the title I came up with was Why the Right Got Bored with Economic Freedom. And the thing is, some of these people on the right who got bored with economic freedom are friends of mine. Like, I like these people. They have great insights on a lot of things, but they ain't no good on this. And this book, The Church and the Market, from 20 years ago, this book won a big book prize. It caused a lot of controversy, but in a good way. And I was aiming this book not at the left. Some of my books are kind of meant to be criticisms of the left. Occasionally, I get one that's a criticism of the neocons. But this was meant as a critique of actually the right wing, like the traditionalist wing of Catholicism, but not just of Catholicism. There's a traditionalist wing of the conservative movement. And some of those people are not very good on economics. So they will say things like, you know, what I want is for families to prosper, you know, and I want stable employment so that families will prosper. And that's great. But what we need to remember is we actually, believe it or not, have a body of knowledge that's been laboriously accumulated over the years that helps us with these outcomes, helps us to get you where you want to be. And there's been, I think, it's a sliver, but it's a loud sliver of the church that is not left liberal. These are not, we're not talking about Pope Francis. We're talking about traditionalists who would say that the free market is a creation of the Enlightenment, and we don't like the Enlightenment. That was bad. And so this has to be rejected. And instead, what we need is a third way. You know, we don't want communism, but we also don't want freedom of contract either, because what these people will say is that capitalism and communism really are born from the same anthropology. And as soon as you hear anthropology, forget debating these people, that the pomposity is through the roof. You know, communism and its exact opposite are really kind of the same thing. They say, okay, fine. You know, a system that has violently enforced collective ownership of the means of production on the one hand, and a system that has private property the means of production on the other. These are really the same thing. All right, you know, you're really going to roll the dice and decide between the Soviet Union and the United States? All right, that's what your position is. So I just decided there needs to be something that takes these people on. And in particular, that, you know, once people are in their 50s, like me, they're pretty set in their ways. My thought was, what about all these young, impressionable kids, you know, who think, well, the cool way to be right wing is to be anti-free market because they won't see that coming. And I was just like, yeah. So the long and the short of it is, I wrote this because I share the goals of these people. Of course, I want to see households prosper. You know, of course, I want to see people's kids grow up and be able to have as prosperous a life as the parents. You know, we all want that, but you can't get there by wishing, you know, or by using your will. You know, like it, you know, the we can't have the free market. What we need is a man with a strong will to enforce his will on society, and that'll get us where we want to be. Forget your so-called economic laws, but this is like saying, we, you know, forget your gravity. We can have a ruler who just orders things to float in the air if we want. It's as preposterous to talk that way. And so, as I say, we have this body of knowledge, and we would get a lot closer where we want to be if we would learn from it.
You mentioned the importance of the Austrian school. You cite its origins with Karl Menger. What is it about Austrian economics specifically that makes it so valuable as opposed to just your regular economics textbook?
Well, in the book, I develop why Catholics and Christians ought to find something particularly congenial in Austrian economics, but I'll leave that to readers of the book. You can find gems like that. The book is called The Church and the Market. You can find it. I can send you one. I'll figure out something because I've got a bunch of them and I don't know what to do with them. So you can always write to me and we'll work out some mutually beneficial arrangement, because that's what Austrian economics is all about, is marveling at the mutual good that comes from a voluntary interaction. If you didn't think the church and the market was going to be worth more than the money you gave me for it, you wouldn't give me the money. And if I wouldn't rather have the money, I wouldn't part with the book. You know, I mean, it's these little insights that when accumulated form a tremendous edifice of knowledge. But the general response to this, you know, that you would, let's say, that you would elucidate for somebody who is just a reasonably educated person but not a specialist in economics, would be to say that Austrian economics was economics for the longest time. It was the way economics was done. And it was only as the 20th century proceeded that we got all this mathematizing and I'm going to run a regression and all the rest of it. We're going to use calculus and we're going to make economics seem to be kind of like the hard sciences. But there are a lot of reasons that it can't be like the hard sciences. And Ludwig von Mises went out of his way to explain that. And again, I would think a traditionalist in particular would favor an economics that tries to view human beings as human beings, not as subatomic particles, you know, or even more than that, you know, viewing human beings as like little robots that operate according to the prejudices of economists you know, the way they think human beings ought to operate. Little profit maximizers walking around, evaluating their every option according to whether it maximizes their money income. Austrian economics is not like that. It views human beings as having goals of their own, as not being so-called economic men who are motivated entirely by material things, because we're not. I mean, you yourself, listening to this, know that that does not motivate or explain every single thing you do. And so therefore, the problem is the reason you want to think of human beings this way is that it becomes a lot easier to graph them and put them in equations. But if they have free will and they all have different motivations, it's hard to flatten them out in this way. But you can still nevertheless draw certain conclusions about human beings. It doesn't mean that just because not everything we do is motivated by money, that, well, I guess therefore we can't study human beings. What Mises showed is that with the help of what he calls praxeology, we can in fact deduce certain exact laws of economics. Not numerically exact, obviously, because there are no constants in human action. Because again, we're dealing with, we're not dealing with inanimate objects. But we can nevertheless go from the insight that human beings act, which means they pursue their ends and they use the scarce means of the world to pursue these ends. From that, you can actually draw out enough information to arrive at things like the law of demand, the law of diminishing marginal utility, some of these laws that we refer to in economics that we don't derive from going out with clipboards and studying human behavior. We derive them from the very logic of what it means to act in this world in the first place. And so this is a kind of study that I think would be appealing to anybody who thinks there's an order to the universe. And again, I would think that would be a lot of the Christian population, but even non-Christians like the Stoics very much believe there was an order to the universe. And that doesn't have to stop with the belief that there's an order in how the physical universe operates. There can also be an order in how society functions and how society operates. And that as you study Austrian economics, you learn how you can enjoy a prosperous, functional society. And you also learn different things that would, let's say, interfere with that society. Like we even learn, in fact, Roger Garrison used to say with Hayek that in order to understand how the economy goes wrong, we first need to understand how it could ever go right. What is it about the economy that makes it so that we all have these preferences as consumers, and these preferences involve the allocation of a numberless amount of resources that could be allocated in an infinite number of different combinations to yield an equally infinite number of possible arrays of consumer goods. But yet all we have to do is demand a certain array of consumer goods, and we have an economy that generates it for us. And there's nobody in charge of it, quote unquote, who says, all right, well, look, people want pencils, so I guess, Fred, you better go head up the pencil division. None of that's necessary. You don't have to do any of that because there's something about the economy that makes it so that it's not perfect. We can't get the absolutely perfect instantiation of everybody's desires at any given moment. For one thing, because people's tastes are changing, resource availability is changing, technological capabilities are changing, but we can come as close as it is humanly possible to come to generating an outcome that satisfies as many preferences as possible. Now, that is an astonishing thing. And Austrian economics, and really economics in general, helps you understand how are these miracles possible? How is it possible it seems like that should require central planning. And yet, the more central planning we have, the more chaos we have in society. It's the very opposite of what you would think. And once we appreciate that, how it's possible to have order in society, then we find where is the disorder coming from? And that's where we get into things like Why do we have recessions? Like, these things have explanations. It's not simply, and I hate to disparage the otherwise wonderful Pope Pius XI, but when he in Quadragesimo Anno was trying to understand what had caused the Depression, the best he could come up with was greed, which is not a satisfying explanation. Because, of course, greed is greed's always around. There's no reason that it should be confined to the period 1929 to 1932. You know, that like so what? So instead, it's better to try to figure out, well, what was it about that particular moment? What was going on at that particular moment that was unusual? What had created the conditions such that greed, which is normally kept in check, apparently, because we're not always in depression, suddenly led the economy to go completely astray? And that's when we get into the theory of the business cycle and so on. So in other words, if you want to understand how the world works, you know, and not just have it be a series of your own prejudices. Well, I think it's rich people who do X and Y, or greed causes this and that. If you really want to have an understanding of what's going on so as to be able to maximize the prospects for good and minimize the prospects for evil, well, then you ought to study the great Austrian economists.
On page 19, you address a criticism that we come across very often, where the response is, you people are constantly talking about this theory and that theory and how you'd like the world to be. Knock it off with this nonsense. Let's talk about the real world. On page 19, you defend the concept of theory, saying, without some coherent theory, Hans Hermann Hoppe observes, it is impossible to make sense of empirical data. Please explain that in depth.
All right. So let's say we are trying to understand, like, why does the business cycle occur? Well, how would we find that out? By simply starting by gathering data. What data would we gather? How would we know what data to gather? Should we be gathering the food people are eating for breakfast every morning? Is that relevant to the question? So even to pursue the question, we have to have be grounded in the problem already, because what data would be necessary? Rothbard used to give the example of, or you know what, this may have been Mises, now that I think about it, may have been Mises. Well, it could, whichever one it was, I'm a little rusty on this. But they say, let's think about somebody taking a look at the comings and goings at Grand Central Terminal in New York City. Now, to the, let's say the exclusively empirical eye, it looks as if it's a chaos of coming and going, a complete chaos. Some people going this way, some people going that way, and no rhyme or reason apparently to any of it. But then if we approach it with the benefit of theory, and the theory in this case being that human beings are pursuing their goals, and at Grand Central Terminal, they typically are there so that they can use the trains to arrive at particular places, accomplish certain goals, and then return, well, then suddenly this seemingly random series of comings and goings makes sense. It's not a random series of comings and goings after all. Well, likewise, if we're going to try to understand something like the business cycle, what, why does the economy move in what appears to be like a sine wave? It's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. It's not obvious that it should go that way. It seems rather that the economy should gradually move slightly upward and upward in like a maybe a slight zigzag fashion, but generally upward. Because after all, the economy selects for the best entrepreneurs. People who are very bad at allocating resources make losses, and they find their resources being depleted, and ultimately they make losses or go out of business, and they're replaced by people who are better stewards of resources. So over time, you should get ever better economic decisions being made because the resources are being placed in more skilled hands. So it seems like the line should go like this rather than like this. So what is actually going on? Is there something economy-wide that's happening that could account for this economy-wide wave movement? And so that is, so the Austrians would say, well, let's think about that question. What is a phenomenon that is economy-wide? Well, money. Because money is half of every single transaction with very few frivolous and trivial exceptions. Money is half of every single transaction. So if something is affecting negatively every single transaction, in effect, or a lot of them, then we should start. It's only common sense that we should start by looking at the money, because money is everywhere in the economy. We'll look at the money and see if anything is going on, what's being interfered with in the money. And so that's how we first know, well, money is going to have to be a big part of this story. Now let's go and see what's going on with the money. Is the money being manipulated in some way? Is the supply of money being changed? Like, what could be going on that affects the money? And so there, instead of just, I mean, we could stare all day long at production figures. We could indeed stare at the money supply. We could stare at interest rates, but we wouldn't know what we were looking for, would we? I mean, nothing's going to jump off the page to say, and here's the explanation for what's going wrong. It's when we understand first that money is almost certainly at the heart of this. And then secondly, we understand first, as Roger Garrison says, what is it that's going right in the economy? How is it that we are getting our needs satisfied with all these heterogeneous goods and all these different entrepreneurs allocating these goods at just the right moment in just the right combinations? What's making that break down? We understand that it works. What could make that break down? What is something that is economy-wide that could cause entrepreneurs to make faulty decisions? And what's one of these things that's economy-wide? Interest rates, which help people determine when they ought to borrow, what length of production process they ought to engage in. There are all kinds of questions tied up in interest rates. And what do you know? On the eve of these downturns, there's been fiddling with interest rates, forcing them down artificially because we think there's a shortcut to prosperity to be had by forcing interest rates down artificially. So now we're getting sort of to the heart of what might be going on. We're groping towards some kind of explanation. But without this kind of general understanding of what's going on, we would be left with simply staring at random sheafs of numbers and statistics that on their own do not tell any story whatsoever. They're just a series of numbers. But coupled with these other insights, a story does emerge. A story leaps off the page. But without a grounding in theory, you're going to be fruitlessly staring at numbers, and there ain't nothing those numbers are going to tell you.
On page 42, you summarize Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson by saying, economic reasoning involves considering the long-run effects on the entire economy that a given measure is likely to have, rather than on its obvious and visible short-run effects on a particular sector. So walk us through the example. Either use price gouging or rent control as a way of showing us how this lesson works in practice, please.
Okay, I'd like to call an audible here and do two examples. One drawn from your two choices you gave me, and another one drawn from one I just found myself arguing about just the other day, just to show that the book may be 20 years old, but the stuff in there is as fresh as ever. So the other day, I was on Twitter, and somebody was saying, you know, the problem with Tucker Carlson, as soon as they start saying that, I know, whatever it is, I'm not going to like it. But they were retweeting something that Tucker had written about Israel. And the person was saying, Tucker's problem is he doesn't talk about the good side. So, for example, Tucker never mentions that so much of the monetary aid that goes to Israel has to be spent on defense firms in America, and that's good for the American economy. So you've heard this, Keith, and that's good for the economy. And so I said, if you think taxing the American public, sending it abroad, and then sending it back here earmarked for particular companies, in other words, you tax Americans, take their money from them, and then spend that money on things they wouldn't have spent it on. If you think that bolsters the economy, you're dumber than AOC. Because that's the right-wing problem. So, I mean, I guess that's a neocon sort of argument, is they're trying to say, well, that bolsters the economy. That's exactly the way Bernie Sanders thinks, by the way. You know, it bolsters the economy if we tax people and spend it on whatever. But, of course, let's think about, you know, the effects on it, the long-term effects on everybody. So, yeah, of course, we can see the short-term effects of taking money from Keith Knight and handing it to a military military industrial complex firm is that that firm prospers. Yeah, duh. Like any idiot can see that. But you're forgetting about old Keith here. Keith ain't prospering, right? You know, that's very short-sighted. You forgot about Keith and all the other people who were looted for this. Those people had hopes and dreams. Those people had, you know, when we think maybe, I don't know, it was $800 a person or something. I bet Keith had some earmarked purpose for that $800, and it sure wasn't sending it to Raytheon. So that does not help the economy, because now we have to think about everybody else and not just the earmarked recipient. Any dope can see that the earmarked recipient of largesse from the taxpayers prospers. We can see that. We can see that. But the issue is, what about everybody who got looted? What about all the things that now don't get built because that money has been siphoned off for some other purpose? And secondly, the purposes for which the taxpayers would have spent the money are purposes that we know benefit the public because they chose to make the expenditures. Whereas if you loot somebody, like you have to loot them to get this transaction to take place, that means it's not preferred by the public. See, the great thing about a voluntary transaction is that we can know that ex ante, that both parties benefit. You know, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think I would benefit, and the person on the other side of the transaction wouldn't have done it if he didn't think he would benefit. But if you have to, if a thief comes over and takes my money, we can't say both parties benefited because I didn't agree to that. If I agreed to it, that shows that I want it. Well, taxation is like a big thief. And if a thief is necessary to bring about the transaction, then we cannot say society has been made better off. You know, you could say, well, Raytheon benefits more than you lose. Well, how do you know? You're going to get into their heads and compare their subjective sense of satisfaction to mine? There's no way to know. So all we can say is it's unknowable. But chances are probably we would have to say this is not good for society. So that's one. But now to take an example you gave the price gouging example. Now, I live in Florida, which means we have our share of hurricanes, which also means we have our share of do-gooders saying, don't price gouge. I, meanwhile, am desperately trying to tell people, please price gouge. Please. Because I actually happen to like mankind, and I have a brain. So therefore, I favor so-called price gouging, which is typical of the left. They have to name noble things with bad names. You know, like somebody who simply wants to go take a job that somebody else prefers not to take is called a scab. You know, like they can't just say, an employment seeker. No, of course not. A scab. So likewise, price gouging, you know, it's like they're gouging your eyes out because they're charging you, you know, too much for some Cheez-Its or something, whatever it is they're selling. But the idea basically runs like this. We have a hurricane. We got to rebuild. So we need lumber to rebuild. Now, the way we get lumber to rebuild is we make it really worth people's while to supply us with lumber. You allow us to bid up the price of lumber such that we divert it from less urgent uses. So somebody two states away who was going to use some lumber to build a doghouse, you know, the dog could stay in the guy's house. You know, you don't need a doghouse this particular moment when there's this emergency going on. He'll suddenly find the price of lumber has gone up a bit. And that's Florida's way of saying we really need the lumber down here. You know, wait a few weeks to build the doghouse. But right now we really need that lumber now. If the price is allowed to go up, then people who otherwise would have said, I'm going to take the weekend off and relax, will say, I'm going to take the weekend and drive as much lumber down to Florida as I possibly can because of that. And then as time goes on, of course, that will bring a kind of equilibration of prices. The price of lumber will slowly come back down. But if you simply say, nope, that price can't go up, then all these extra supplies of lumber that people would have brought in voluntarily are not going to be brought in. And you'll have less lumber than you would have had, which means a longer and more laborious rebuilding process. If you say hotels can't increase their prices for hotel rooms okay, well, here's what would have happened if the hotel price had been able to go up 30%, is a family of six decides, you know what, we'll just scrunch into one room. You know, I mean, with Abraham Lincoln lived in a log cabin the size of two pool tables. I think for three nights, we can stay, the six of us, in one hotel room. Whereas if the price doesn't go up, they might say, all right, well, mom, why don't you take two of the kids in one room and I'll take two of the kids in the other. And now we're using up two hotel rooms. Whereas if we have to conserve, we have now freed up another hotel room for somebody else to use. And hotel rooms can't just appear overnight. We can't increase the supply of hotel rooms overnight. What we can do is make people want to conserve on them so that the existing supply of hotel rooms can now extend farther and stretch farther to be able to accommodate more people. So if we look at just the immediate run, we could say, yeah, look, we've made hotel rooms cheaper than they were before for the people who were lucky enough to get them. And that's the end of the story? No, as Hazlitt would say, you have to not just look at the earmarked people. Again, the earmarked people are going to be fine. You know, the people who are able to run fast and get to the hotel really quickly and use up all the rooms at the cheap price, they're going to be fine. And you know what? Even the rich people, the envy-driven people who favor these price gouging laws, they think they're going to stick it to the rich. You know, the rich can't just buy their way to hotel. You know what? Rockefeller can send his assistant to stand in line for him and get him a hotel room. You know, so you're not even going to beat the rich on that. So just so get your envy out of the way of our rebuilding, is what I would say. But so in the long run, the issue is, we now have fewer hotel rooms available. So now you have some people who can't find lodging at all, at any price. And that's a bad thing. Or when it comes to the rebuilding, we have people who are left without shelter, or left without a residence for longer than would otherwise have been the case. So it's not just that that guy was able to get cheap lumber. I'm sure he was. But what about all the other people?
When it comes to the concept of trade and tariffs, I would like to use the method you use in Diary of a Psychosis, where you compare states that had severe lockdowns to states that did not have lockdowns. Let's do that with free trade. Is there a correlation between countries that have embraced free trade and seen an increase in standard of living compared to countries that trade less and have lower standards of living? Is there a way to falsify the free trade improved standard of living thesis?
Yeah, there probably is. I mean, a great example is Hong Kong, a very, very small place. So there's absolutely no way it could engage in autarky, even if it wanted to. So therefore, it doesn't want to. It just opens itself up to trade with the world. And you'd be out of your mind to think that Hong Kong doesn't have an excellent standard of living. And in fact, Rothbard used to make the point that the smaller the country is, the more obvious it is that it can't get by on its own production alone. And so it has to open itself up to international trade. And when we look at, let's say, developing countries going from poverty to, let's say, mid-range level to prosperity, it's hard to find examples of ones that said, we're going to cut ourselves off to international trade. The ones that prospered the fastest are the ones that embraced international trade. And I realize that in saying that, this puts me at odds with some of the right wingers who are going to think all you care about is, you know, cheap goods from China or whatever the complaint is. But it's like, I mean, I really do think that the analogy drawn by Frederick Bastiat in the Petition of the Candlemakers, I really do think that's apt, that the candlemakers are saying, look, how could we be expected to compete against the sun? It's free. What kind of unfair competition is this? It gives away free light all the time. So what we need to do is block out the sun, and that way we will sell more candles. All right, but is that the way? So in a similar way, if there were people on Mars and they came to Earth and they said, we have a way to make, let's say, 20% of your consumer goods 40% cheaper. And it would just be by pushing a button, 40% cheaper, which would mean 40% increase in real incomes to the extent that, you know, that's what people are buying. So you would all become instantly wealthier as a result of this, because you'd have more money left over now after you buy these consumer goods. What would we say to that? Would we say, no, we indignantly send you away? This is going to make me worse off? I want to pay more for things?
You have a section titled Prices, Wages, and Labor. So if I'm just looking at, all right, you got me dead to rights on capitalism provides cheap goods for the masses, which improves their standard of living. But the average person spends 5 days a week, 8 hours a day at their job. So in the case of working conditions, being treated with respect by your boss, the importance of maybe having a union or a guild, if I want high wages and good, respectable working conditions, why should I support a free market economy, the contractual economy, as opposed to one where there's state intervention looking out on the workers' behalf?
Right. Okay. Well, when your society is poor, it almost doesn't matter what kind of government you have. Your job's going to be terrible. There's just no getting around that. Your job's going to be terrible. So the issue is not what's the perfect system. It's what's the best way to get from a bad situation to a better one. So let's think about I used to draw an analogy, and I am so out of practice with this analogy, Keith. I'm not even sure I can carry it out. But let's imagine that all the machinery that we use right now to produce goods, all the assembly lines and the robots and the whatever it is, the cranes, the everything we use to produce things, suddenly gets destroyed, like aliens whisked it away overnight. And we wake up and basically we have to just use our bare hands, or we have to use very, very primitive tools. All these things are gone. So what would the first thing be that we would notice? First, there'd be some classes of goods we could not produce at all anymore. Like, I don't think you could produce a TV with your bare hands alone, like all the raw materials you'd need. So no TVs anymore, okay? Or other things you could produce, but probably lower quality, or at the very least in far lower quantities, because you don't have the machinery to carry out the mass production. What we would also notice is our standard of living would plummet, because it wouldn't be a case of the rich are hoarding all the TVs. It would be that there aren't any TVs for anybody. So that wouldn't be the problem. The problem would be nobody can get these things, or even the things that are produced exist in such low quantities that not everybody can get them. So the reason that your paycheck wouldn't go very far isn't that your employer is wickedly depriving you of more consumer goods. It's that you're operating in a society that doesn't have very many goods to sell you. So no matter how much money I print, when you go into the marketplace, there just aren't enough things. So what would we want to do in that society? We'd want to get the machines back. We would want to get the machines back. So what would we have to do? We would have to save money and take that savings and devote it toward producing more capital goods, machinery. And slowly but surely, we would be able to produce more things and our standard of living would improve. So that scenario where the aliens come and take all the machines, that's basically where people were roughly on the eve of the Industrial Revolution. That's exactly where they were. They may as well have been living in a high capital intensive society, and one day aliens took everything away. I mean, that was the society they had. So what was the way out of that? Unionizing? There's no stuff to buy. Unionizing? Talk about missing the point. What you need, you know, I'm going to try to wring a little more out of my employer. Okay, if you might wring like one table leg extra out of your employer. The society is dirt poor and can't produce anything. What you want is an employer that earns profits and reinvests them in the purchase of machinery to make the economy more capital intensive, and to make it so that when you get your paycheck and you go into the marketplace to buy things, there's a ton of things to buy. And because there's a ton of things to buy, the quantity of things pushes prices down. And that makes it prices in terms of wages. and you find that you're able to buy more things. That is how people's standard of living increased over time. It wasn't that they grabbed more from their employers. It was, as George Reisman says, because we beat these people back long enough. We beat the redistributors back long enough to be able to invest the profits in the kind of machinery that creates abundance, and the abundance through competition pushes prices down to levels that make mass consumption possible. So, and then meanwhile, things like, I give the example of air conditioning, like the actual conditions of work. We'd all like to work in an air-conditioned environment. But now let's imagine air conditioning has just been invented. And as with anything that's just been invented, it's extremely expensive. What would happen if we demanded everybody must have an air-conditioned workplace immediately upon the invention of air conditioning? We'd all be unemployed. No one could afford that. So how is air conditioning introduced? Is it because unions demand it? Is that how we get air conditioning? Here's what actually happens. Gradually, air conditioning begins to spread throughout the workforce, but gradually. And places that have air conditioning, people are willing to accept slightly less monetary compensation in exchange for their physical comfort. And what begins to happen is the holdouts, the remaining places that don't offer air conditioning, now have to offer substantially higher compensation because everybody would rather be cool all day. You know, like, you'd have to really convince me not to be cool all day. And these are called compensating differentials. You know, it's why a garbage man makes more money than somebody at McDonald's. Like, I have to deal with garbage all day. You're going to have to pay me a little more to compensate me for the difference in work. Well, likewise, you're going to have to pay me so much more to be not air conditioned that it would actually be cheaper just install air conditioning and not pay them more. And that would be that's how it actually happens. There was no law that said everybody has to have air conditioning. So how did we ever get it? There was no law. In the same way that very, very few people actually earn the minimum wage, even though technically the law only says you have to earn minimum wage. So why doesn't everybody just earn minimum wage? According to the theory that only by cracking skulls do we improve standards of living, we should all be in non-air-conditioned workplaces earning minimum wage. But the exact opposite is the truth. So that must be wrong.
You have a chapter titled The Welfare State, The Family, and Civil Society. How is it that things like food stamps, Social Security, compulsory state education, how did those things weaken civil society?
All right. Now, I will grant you that I have a tough row to hoe on this, because this runs absolutely counter to what everybody thinks. And I would also say that in the libertarian world, there is a school of thought called no particular orderism. Have you heard that term?
No.
Okay. Well, I know one person who uses that term, no particular orderism, that I don't care what order the state is dismantled in, as long as it's dismantled. Now, I suppose probably I go along with that more or less. But if I had to go in order, like, you know Ron Paul's thing, that first we go after the military-industrial complex. We don't first go after the hungry family through no fault of their own. You know what I mean? Like, we go after the fat cats. And then as time goes on, we say to everybody, look, you know, we all have to just get ourselves off this crazy system. So I would say, first of all, we go after the low-hanging fruit. But then when we look at, like, in terms of things like food stamps, the numbers, I don't have them offhand. I have some in the book from 20 years ago, but it's just shot through the roof, the number of people who are on these programs. And the trouble is that there is a certain cultural consequence to being on programs like this over time. And I grew up in a blue-collar household. We had nothing handed to us. But my father would have died 1,000 deaths before letting anybody other than himself provide food for his family. He would have taken on whatever work was necessary to provide food for his family, because that was a matter of his own dignity. And that was a matter of teaching his family that you rely on your neighbors only as an absolute last resort, because your neighbors have concerns of their own. and struggles of their own, and you should not be a burden on them unless you have absolutely no other choice. But the problem with the welfare state, one of them, is that it accustoms people to this. People grow accustomed to this, to the point where it would seem weird even to feel funny about it, especially because it's done so anonymously. You get a check in the mail and you deposit it, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, whereas the kind of mutual aid societies that existed before we had the welfare state were not anonymous. And it was and they would check up on you, you know. And whereas today it's like the more people you have on your welfare caseload, the better for you. You know, you're building like a little empire. That's not the way civil society operates. We want to get you back integrated into society just as quickly as we possibly can. So, who was it? Charles Murray wrote about this in his book Losing Ground back in 1984 about the way the welfare state erodes the kind of habits and behaviors and ideas that we want to encourage in people. And this seems like not a big deal, but it is a big deal. We used to have they had to wear people's resistance down to get them to accept some of these programs, because this was not what they were taught to do. I wish I could remember the name of the movie. Maybe you know it, Keith. And it involved a boxer who was up and coming, and his family did accept welfare. This is probably back in the 30s, did accept welfare payments. And then he hit it big, and he calculated the amount that they had taken, and he paid it back. You know, whereas today, people would think you were a sucker for doing something like that. But this is why we want to absolutely minimize this kind of thing. The easiest thing in the world is just say, well, we'll just have a program and that'll resolve it. But the trouble is, the program encourages more people to get in the position to make themselves eligible for the program. In that book, Losing Ground, Charles Murray takes the example of, suppose the government wanted to come up with a program to get people to quit smoking. And the analogy here is to a program to get people to not be poor anymore. And he goes through and shows that no matter how you design the incentives of this program, at the end of it, you're going to have more people smoking than you did at the beginning. And it's a brilliant analogy. So you can read Charles Murray's book, or you can read my telling of it, which is much shorter, in The Church and the Market. But these consequences are not obvious. You know, it's not like you don't immediately see these things in society. You might not even think about them. You might think, well, this clearly is the best thing to do. But in the long run, it may actually be making the society worse off, poorer, the productive class smaller, and the base at the bottom demanding ever more goods from the private sector ever larger. That takes a long explanation, unfortunately.
Yeah, it seems like it essentially takes a society where each additional person is a potential asset. Hey, another potential trading partner, another potential customer for my organization, takes them from assets and turns them into liabilities. Hey, Tom, I just had a kid. Guess what that means? You now owe him healthcare, and you owe him an education, and you owe him housing. Oh, guess what? I had another one. Now you owe him housing and free food and free healthcare and college education, which is going to turn him into some Bolshevik who's completely economically illiterate. So it creates this tension that almost otherwise I feel like it would not be there, that when I get off work and I busted myself for hours and I'm waiting for my groceries to be checked out, and the person in front of me pays with an EBT card. Now, I get that this is not the Curtis LeMay evil statist who I need to hate, but a part of me is like, this appears to be somewhat of an apartheid state where people have different rights. She has the right to acquire food by having some people use aggression and threats thereof to acquire resources for herself and her kids. I have no such recognized right. Surely, if she had the right to vote and I couldn't vote, you'd recognize that as unjust inequality and terrible apartheid. But she has a right to acquire massive amounts of resources through involuntary methods that I don't. This welfare state, even the food stamps example, which people will say that'll be the last thing to go. Traffic lights and food stamps will be the last things we'll abolish. well, no, I'm sorry, food stamps are going to have to be a little higher on this one. Do you see my point about turning
people from
assets into liabilities?
I want to refer people now. I'm so sorry that I can't remember the name. I think it's the North American Motor Company, but my brain is telling me that's slightly off. But it's the part of Atlas Shrugged where they tell the story of a company that really did operate according to the principle from each according to his ability to each according to his need. I think it's the most compelling thing Ayn Rand ever wrote. And you can find it, like, if you do a search for, again, I think it's North American Motor Company, Ayn Rand, whatever. And you should be able to find just that excerpt. I found it on a blog once. And actually, it's time to read that to daughter Elizabeth. I've read that to my daughters as they've gotten old enough. Because it's a worker from the company who recalls what happened. And when you read that to somebody, it inoculates them. If you read it at the right age, it inoculates that person against evil, brutal, violent socialist ideas. And the reason that came to mind, Keith, is that your example about your point about every person now being a liability rather than an asset. Well, he says, you know, at the beginning, we used to cheer when a fellow worker would have a baby. We used to cheer. We'd have a party. We'd all bring gifts. And, you know, and then he describes the process by which everything meant we had to work more. Everything meant overtime. Like everybody was trying to grab because we all realized that the people still, you know, that was the only way to prosper in this system was just to grab as much as you could. And the thing is, that story moves so logically from everybody's happy and committed to this noble goal to everybody is at each other's throats and would slit those throats if they could. There is not one step in that progression that is implausible. So I cannot recommend that highly enough. In fact, poor Elizabeth Woods has no idea she is what she's in for tonight. I'm going to be sitting here reading that to her saying, well, absorb this.
Turn the microphone on and record it because
the estate of Ayn Rand is huge on on copyright. I would get in
they
trouble.
They sued Reason Magazine. I know. On page 161, I think you make the most important point, the most commonly cited point that people in my age demographic make when it comes to criticizing capitalism and the free market. You say, referring to distributists, they contend that the market order introduces an intolerable level of insecurity and anxiety into the economic life of the ordinary person. So, Tom, I'm sick of this work or starve society. I'm sick of the anxiety that comes along with, oh, if I miss that rent payment, if I don't get that bill, I'm going to be homeless or I'm going to have to beg grandma to let me stay in her guest room. What do you have to say to that mindset?
Where would you rather be poor would be my question. Like, what kind of country would you rather be poor in? Would you rather be poor? I mean, you could be poor in India if you want. I bet they have a lot of programs for you. But the issue would be, where would I want to be poor if I had to be poor? I'd rather be poor in the most capital-intensive country, the most market-oriented country, because that will have generated the most wealth to support me. And in fact, a guy named Bob Lawson, Lawson, I'm not sure which university he's at now, but I've known him a while, did a study of this, and he found that there is a correlation between how market-oriented a country is and how few deprivations the poor in that country suffer. It's a direct connection. And so he said that this ought to have influenced John Rawls, you know, who said that we need to favor the poor in all the decisions we make. Okay, then I guess we need to have the most market-oriented society because that makes the poor the best off. You know, it's almost like, you know, Ayn Rand used to say, and I think it's the only episode I've ever cited Ayn Rand twice. They think libertarians, that's all we talk about is Ayn Rand. It's my only time ever citing her twice. But she said, you know, don't assume that your opponents really have the welfare of the poor at heart. Don't assume that. You have no reason to assume that. If they really did, they would favor the market economy because it generates the most wealth. And it means that the poor suffer the fewest deprivations. You know, if If they cared about the poor, that's what they would favor. If they don't know that capitalism does that, then they're too lazy to be entitled to an opinion in the first place.
That was Thomas Sowell's point at the end of Social Justice Fallacies. He says, you know, they say they care about the poor a lot, but they seem to have complete lacks of interest in asking, what about Singapore? What did Hong Kong do to become so successful? Why is it that Taiwan and South Korea kind of just randomly, according to you people, gained access? Weren't there a bunch of greedy capitalist exploiters? Why was East Germany less well off than West Germany? Do they have any interest in these topics? I had not heard Rand say that, but I was familiar with Thomas Sowell saying that. There's two more things that I want to go over. Okay. You mentioned my favorite example of revisionist history. On page 176, you summarize the findings of Tom DeLorenzo in his 1985, The Origins of Antitrust in Interest Group Perspective. A lot of times we'll hear that when we tried this free market capitalism idea, you had a few people extracting all this wealth, and that's why we ended up having more regulations that came. But people like Rockefeller, Carnegie, Vanderbilt, there's a reason they're called the robber barons. They were basically thieves extracting the wealth of the laboring masses. What do you have to say to that mindset?
All right. Well, now, if you say anything about Rockefeller, immediately everybody says, but Rockefeller is an evil SOB. Okay. Whatever you want to say about Rockefeller, leave that aside, because we're isolating only economics here. Okay. We're just looking at economics, because in the interest of saying that Rockefeller's a bad guy, I am not going to support communism. Okay. So what, you know, Rockefeller, in terms of what he did for oil, was a benefactor. Yes, I'm going to say it, was a benefactor to mankind, because thanks to his cost cutting and oil refinery, the standard of living rose considerably. Likewise for Carnegie and for Vanderbilt. I went to examples of that. I also have this in the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. But what Tom DeLorenzo found, because he bothered to look. Everybody thinks they already know the answer, so they don't bother to look. So Tom bothered to go look to see, did the industries that were being condemned as monopolies in their day and in the, you know, the outraged textbooks of our day, were these industries actually monopolized? And he said, well, let's look at what the neoclassical definition of monopoly is. It's that they cut production and they increase prices. So let's look. Let's look. He says there are 17 industries for which we have data where these accusations were flying. And he says, well, in all but two of them, we see that the two were matches and castor oil, you know, not exactly, you know, most urgent products in the world. In all but two of them, prices fell in real terms, fell for consumers, and output increased. So the exact opposite of the dictionary definition of monopoly. The exact opposite occurred. But yet, I would be willing to bet that no professor at Harvard University or Columbia even knows that. I bet that not, I would be willing to bet not one of them even knows that. So yeah, that is important to know.
And we have examples today that Amazon and Walmart have grown large, and Apple have grown large, not because they cater to the 1% yacht owners, because they cater to the masses. So those people are just completely ridiculous. An excellent section of the book is page 202, titled The Profit Motive. You continuously say throughout the book that Group X, who is not exempt from original sin. And I love this because it gets to the heart of these two different ideas that I come across, which is there are people who have what could be called the constrained view, where they believe that selfishness is inherent to the human condition, human since the beginning of time all over the world. Other people believe that selfishness was invented around the Industrial Revolution and then really exacerbated by Ayn Rand and Ronald Reagan, and greed and selfishness are something unique. So when it comes to the concept of, let's say human beings are self-interested, what type of economic system and what type of profit motive would we want society to abide by if we wanted to reap the benefits of the inevitability of human self-interest?
Right. And again, saying that human beings are self-regarding does not mean that every single thing they do thinks nothing of others. You know, that's it. But what it does mean is they are going to look out for providing for their basic necessities and for that of their those of their families. That we know. And that's not a bad thing. It would be wrong for them not to do that. So the issue is, given that we know this, what would be the way that we could minimize harm from this aspect of human nature? And the way we would minimize harm is we have a society in which, in order to prosper, you have to please others. And the more you please others, I mean, it's like the better you'll do. I mean, you know Zig Ziglar's thing. You can get everything you want in life as long as you help as many people as possible get what they want. And I know people are cynical about this. Well, such and such company prospers through wickedness. I know. And they'll get their reward someday, you know. But in general, like you and me, like I, you know, people like listening to the Tom Woods Show. That's why I can make a living from it. You know, like that's the thing. I mean, people... like this computer I'm working on is like a miracle. This thing's a miracle. You know, I couldn't, if I had 100,000 lifetimes, I couldn't come up with something like this. Somebody made this for me and, you know, for, to improve his own life. And think about the research. Like if I had to make this on my own, without any of the capital equipment they have, whatever, could you imagine the years and years and years of labor and the expenditure, and this computer cost me, what, maybe $600? That is essentially zero compared to what it would have cost me if I tried to do it all on my own. It's essentially zero. It's like nothing. So yeah, I would say that system works pretty well.
Yeah, the example I use in my book is there are well-meaning leftists who actively watch Netflix knowing that there are starving people in the world. They spend money on luxuries when they know they could give it to the homeless people. I ask people to compare how they feel if one of their family members dies and compare that to their thoughts on the 150,000 deaths during the Franco-Prussian War. If self-interest were something that leftists have, you know, surmounted, well, then they'd be 150,000 times more devastated by those deaths than the one in their family. But because they're self-interested, of course, they don't even have the self-interest to give me the courtesy of not calling me a racist sexist after they have no evidence and I beg them to stop. And they think they're like so caring about these billions of people. Okay, this will be the actual last thing. You mentioned how crazy it is that you have access to this computer and it's produced for the masses. Is one of the fallacies with people that they think genius is so easy to come across that, well, yeah, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos, they came up with these ideas. But if we had worker-owned cooperatives, you could have the same thing. You'd have all the benefits and you wouldn't have these downsides. Is that one of the fundamental flaws? They underestimate how valuable and how unique and how rare genius actually is. And they think everyone could be a genius, but we just have to have welfare and an education system
to give them money. There could be some of that, the disparaging of genius. And there's probably also in tandem with that, a failure to appreciate the complexity of certain systems. I mean, the fact that Walmart has figured out that it's in their interest to hire somebody to stand at the door and say, "Welcome to Walmart," shows that they've been doing this a while. Like they actually have calculated that it's better for them to do that. Or they have inventory methods that are such that, an average person can do inventory work there because it's all computerized and simple. You just push a button. But the complexity of this conceals the complexity that is fundamentally at work here. I think people seem to think that the enjoyment that they get from all the wonderful things in the economy, that these things are just automatic. Like there's nothing that's necessary to sustain it. It just happens somehow. They don't know how. You know, it reminds me of, what's that guy? Richard Taney, speaking of Martin Luther, and I'm not trying to single out Protestants here, but he said, when Luther is looking at the economy, he says, it is as if a savage is trying to examine a dynamo or a steam engine. You know, he can make no sense of it, but he knows there's a devil in it somewhere, you know? And here, it's not so much they think there's a devil in it, it's that they are like savages looking at a steam engine. They don't know how it works, but it doesn't even occur to them that they need to know, that it does work, that there is something behind it. These things are just automatic. Prosperity is just automatic. Now we just have to figure out, you know, what distribution or whatever, but prosperity just occurs. They don't know how, but it occurs.
That's why I have a positive right to it, just because it naturally occurs. I love this book, The Church and the Market. Thank you for writing it and celebrating the 20th anniversary with me.
Thank you very much, Keith. And I want to encourage people to check out libertarianinstitute.org, where Keith does very important work with Scott Horton and other great people. So check that out. And also, don't forget, you got to meet, I have a new son coming in 2026. I have 5 daughters. Now I have a son. And you're going to get to meet him on board the next Tom Woods cruise. So check that out. Scott's going to join me there too. So check that out, tomwoodscruise.com. And we'll see you next time.
Make yourself and those you love less vulnerable to the regime, both mentally and physically. Get more forbidden information at tomsfreebooks.com. And be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen. See you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.